Do you think life is simpler as time evolves? For some, it can be more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Tucker Allen, providing intelligent answers for those thinking about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Okay, welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This week, we're going to continue talking about the unfolding of the lockdown, the fact that now we're a month down the road from where the lockdown first started, the initial stages. Stage one was implemented, I think, at the beginning of May or so.
Right, phase one.
So we're now approaching phase three, and St. Louis County is more conservative, it seems, than some of our neighboring counties, whether that's good or bad. We thought there's nothing more fitting and more informative than to have somebody on who really sees this whole disease phenomena from a geriatric perspective. And Jill, you and I, we've considered various experts to have on in the past,
yes,
and some of whom we've had on. But among the more popular guests that we've had in the past, and it was about a month ago, is Dr. John Morley. Do you want to give us his introduction,
yes,
Jill?
Dr. John Morley, he's a professor with St. Louis University's Division of Geriatric Medicine. Dr. Morley, thank you so much for joining the show again.
It's a great pleasure to be back and talking to the two of you.
So, Dr. Morley, we really value your perspective on this because it is coming from a geriatric perspective, and our audience, as you know, is largely over 65. And for them, this disease looks a little different and feels a little different than it might for the population in general, particularly those younger. And so we think it's helpful to get your comments about kind of the way things have unfolded in the last 30 days or so, and in your comments about the trends in general. So why don't we start with getting your thoughts about the restrictions as they're being lifted in our area, in the St. Louis area?
Yeah, well, I think there are two perspectives. There's the perspective of the younger person. Obviously, we cannot go on without people having jobs, and that's a total disaster, and it's going to continue to be a disaster till we open up. So from that perspective, the quicker we open up, the better we'll do. On the whole, younger people don't have as calamitous a time as older people with COVID-19. The majority of the deaths occur in people over the age of 60. And by the time you get to 80, it's not very good to have. And we know that many, many nursing homes who were basically sent COVID patients from the hospitals have basically been infested with COVID, which is a total disaster for the older person with multiple comorbidities. And most probably one of the biggest mistakes that politicians and administrators made, not necessarily the nursing home administrators, but the governmental administrators, in demanding to a large extent that older people could go into nursing homes and that that was the right place to put them and not keep them in hospital. Where are we now if you're older? I'm going back to work, and I've been back to work for two weeks now. Basically, I'm nearly 75.
Wow.
And quite honestly, that's not an unreasonable thing for me to be doing. I'm pretty healthy, but I do have diabetes, which is one of the risk factors. And we've got to recognize that for older people who have multiple risk factors, going out into public is going to be a problem. So if you're older, we need to try and stay at home. And most importantly, we need to work on that 6-foot distancing. And we need people around us to wear masks, most probably for reasons that I don't understand. Missouri, which in the 1918 Spanish flu was the paradigm of virtue.
Yeah.
Everybody put on a mask. Everybody basically at that time distanced, they locked down. And unlike Philadelphia, where virtually everybody was getting sick and large numbers of people were dying, St. Louis went through it with absolutely flying colors. Now, wherever I go and look out, I find people who are not wearing masks. So I even find that amongst the health professionals that sometimes they're forgetting to wear a mask. And the reason I want them to wear a mask is to protect me. I'm older. I deserve protection. I wear my mask to protect other people. But most importantly, we wear masks because we care about the individuals around us. And I think it's absolutely key that we do that. The quicker we start to learn to do that, and how long we're going to live with it is uncertain, almost certainly most probably through the end of the year. And you know, we just don't want to kill people. And you're walking out there, if you happen to be one of these people who is outside and is one of the carriers who are totally asymptomatic, you will finish up killing people. And quite honestly, that's not a good thing to feel that you did. So hopefully that alone will get people to remember to wear their masks. But we're in a period of flux. We're hoping that we're not going to have another peak at just now. We realize that there is a fair chance that this may happen towards the end of the year, and it may coincide with the influenza peaks. But at the moment, we're hoping that stuff is going to settle down. We're hoping that everybody isn't going to go to the Lake of the Ozarks and run around with one another in the swimming pools to try and see how many people they can get sick with COVID. And some of those will come back and kill their grandparents, if not anybody else. So I hope people will stop being that stupid.
Doctor, you know, I'm glad you brought up about the mask, because medical experts, you know, you hear different opinions about that, but you're saying that you absolutely believe that they are effective.
So the medical data is overwhelmingly good. And you can start off with a wonderful study done with hamsters, where they put hamsters in cages next to one another, and some of them they separated by a mask, and the others weren't separated by a mask. Those who were not separated by a mask, 100% of them got COVID. And those who basically were separated, only 70% got COVID. A recent study showed that it's about the same sort of thing, that when people are wearing masks, about 70%, there's about a 70% decrease in infections in the area with mask wearing. And as I say, we can go back to 1918, where basically St. Louis wore masks. They showed the rest of the world how to handle an epidemic. They did it very well, and we came out much better. And we have to remember that that epidemic didn't start in Spain, the Spanish flu, but actually started at Cape Funtown, which was a military base sending people to World War One, and in Kansas. And we still managed here to control things. So we have to recognize you can do it. The data is very good. The data for spread, when you cough or you basically have a sneeze, or even when you're just talking, to decrease the length that the droplet spread, and droplets are how basically the COVID spreads, is very good. It's most probably when you cough about 10 feet or so, not the 6 feet that we think of. But nevertheless, the further you're away, the less likely you are to get exposed if somebody is wearing a mask. So I know there are physicians who don't believe this. I've had long conversations with some of them, and they all tell me they don't believe it because it's not going to protect them. And that's absolutely true. I do not understand how a healthcare professional could put number one in their life whether it was protecting them. It protects the people around you. And that's the piece that we have to get through to people.
Doctor, what was your thoughts, your response when you saw those images of all those people at Party Cove over Memorial Day weekend?
Well, this made the national news. I was surprised to be reading European news talking about a party at Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri.
No, I mean, Lake of the Ozarks became infamous, and that's about all you can say for it. It was, without doubt, one of the most stupid things I've ever seen a group of people do.
And this is Memorial Day weekend, for those who don't know what we're talking about.
About another week away before we find out how many of those people have infected other people and how many of those infected people will eventually die. And that's 4 to 6 weeks away. This is the problem. The disease takes 1 to 2 weeks before it catches hold of other people. So you don't see an instant effect. But realistically, out of those people in the Lake of the Ozarks, there must be a couple of dozen wandering around Missouri and Kansas now with basically infectious COVID virus, the coronavirus, and trying to see how many people they can infect and how many of those they can kill. It really doesn't make sense for people to do stupid things. And I realize that we're not a nation who wants to wear masks. We think that that's telling us what we should do. But you don't do it because somebody tells you what's what to do. You go and read the literature, you listen to people you trust, and then make a decision. I just don't want to know anybody who wants to kill their grandparents. You know, I don't always like my parents and my grandparents, but gee, I never thought I would want to go out and kill them.
Especially not with a virus.
Well, that is true, but the difference with the virus is that if I went with a gun, I'd know what I was doing. With a virus, we don't know what we're doing, and I think this is why people have so much suspicion. You know, it's the other piece we have to talk about is when we basically get a vaccine. There are so many people now, about 30% of Americans have said they're not going to take the vaccine. Not taking the vaccine is going to not only hurt them, but hurt other people. It's the same with flu. If we can get about 80% of a population vaccinated, we would have virtually no flu at all. But we have so many people who say, oh, the flu shot hurts. I always get flu when I get the flu shot. The COVID-19 vaccine is most probably going to hurt. Most probably some of us are going to get fevers, and people are going to say, well, I'm not going to do that because it's never going to happen to me. You know, we are very fatalistic about the fact that we are so good that nothing is ever going to hurt us. And then when we get hurt, we look around to blame somebody else.
Dr. Morley, the CDC came under fire in recent weeks with a report of mixing the results of the viral and the antibody test. And I wanted to know what your thought was about that. Do you think this is distorting the numbers?
Yeah, so we have to understand the difference between the two. The viral test, the PCR test, is one that shows that you've got active virus on you. This is the one that's really important to know, can you go out? So if you've got a little bit of a cold, if you're feeling sick, if you've got a fever, if you've got chest pain, you need to have that test done to say, am I sick? And if I'm sick, I need to isolate myself for at least 10 days to 2 weeks away from other people so I don't give it to other people. The antibody test is a test which has both good and bad moments at the moment. There seem to be a number of tests out there, and some of them are a little bit like flipping a coin whether you're a positive or not. But the good ones that we've got out there will tell you with a reasonable percentage whether or not you've had the disease. If you've had the disease, it's nice to know. We hope and we would like to believe that if you've had the disease, you're not going to get it again, and also you won't be transmitting it to other people. The problem is we won't know this for certain until 1 or 2 years have gone by, and we see whether or not the antibodies are sufficiently protective to stop us getting it again. But the tests have been all over the place for the antibody. Really a very poor job done by the CDC, where they rushed in to say, well, if you make an antibody, we'll say it's okay and you can go do it, without testing whether or not these were reasonable tests. I mean, overall, as I think we all know, the government, which keeps on telling us you can get a test anywhere, which is why the CDC mixes the tests up, is that basically we could not get tests. I think I said this last time on the program, there were people who clearly had the symptoms who went all over the place trying to get tests and were told they didn't meet the criteria because they couldn't identify anybody they'd been in contact with who had COVID. And this included people who were working in nursing homes being told you cannot have the test. I know nursing homes here where they asked for the test and states said, well, you don't need the test because you don't have anybody who's sick. And then eventually people got sick in the nursing home and it spread rapidly throughout the nursing home. You've got to recognize that the government as a whole, and we can blame here politicians. We could start with Cuomo, who's a good Democrat, who basically allowed New York to say, you've got to send the people out of the hospital to nursing homes, and nursing homes have to take them. And that's why New York had so many people with COVID in their nursing homes. We can start about all the politicians in Washington who made mistake after mistake, changed their mind on day after day. It doesn't matter. People have made huge mistakes in this. Now, I don't blame people for making mistakes, but I think we have to recognize that this was a new disease that came here, and basically we just didn't respond in the quick way we could have. We've got to hope now that things will go better and we won't make more mistakes.
We're talking to Dr. Morley. He's a professor, St. Louis University's Division of Geriatric Medicine. Dr. Morley, I have to get your thoughts regarding, you know, we've had this rioting, the looting, the demonstrations, whatnot in cities across America. I don't know what cities now were added to the list last night. But I have to believe that these would be considered by what the CDC has called the super spreader events. What do you think from the standpoint of spreading COVID-19 will be the effect of these social incidents?
Well, there are two parts. First of all, we have to remember that locking a large number of people down and taking away their jobs for a period of time makes them much more likely to want to try and get food, to want to do things that are not necessarily appropriate. And when you have a very inappropriate behavior by the police, you have to recognize that people are going to behave badly. When you behave badly, you do really stupid things. And again, this is like the Lake of the Ozarks. A subset of people went out, got together, and decided that their job was to basically come close to one another. And lots of them didn't wear masks. Lots of them did. It doesn't matter. And then you run into the trouble that this becomes a wonderful place for that 5% of our population who are going to misbehave. So we see all of it coming together. But the long-term expectation, and I think what you're getting at, is clearly when lots of people come together, not wearing masks, coming closer than the 6 foot all the time, we're going to see an increase in disease. In the first place, most of the people who were out protesting were young people. And we do have to remember African Americans appear to be more vulnerable to the disease. And many of the people protesting were African Americans, quite appropriately. And we have to recognize that this disease will then be carried by some of these people back to the communities, and eventually there will be other spreads in the communities where people came from. I think there's no question about that. And we've got to worry a little bit that the people who went out, protested, didn't wear a mask, didn't think about it in the first place, are going to be the people who go home to their parents and their grandparents, and that's where we will see the major number of deaths. And this will happen over the next 6 weeks or so. So we'll have to trace it back. It will most probably find it's there. And we still don't have great tracing available in the United States. You know, even in the UK, which has done a terrible job at putting together its tracing, it's starting to get there, whereas we are much further apart in most of the United States at being able to early identify somebody who has the disease and trace the people around them and start to lock down the people who may spread the disease.
Now, Doctor, St. Louis County Executive Sam Page recently said that the goal is for the county to test 1,000 residents per day. How much of an impact do you think this will have in combating the virus? Is that enough testing, or would you say we need much more?
I think we most probably need much more. Would have to calculate the exact numbers, but I think that's a relatively low number for the county. The more people you can test, and particularly you need to test every staff in every nursing home, because one staff member coming into the nursing home, an asymptomatic carrier, can basically spread the disease through a whole nursing home. And they are the really vulnerable population. We've got to remember that. So we have to be testing very regularly, looking out for people. It's not their fault that they're asymptomatic and coming to work. We have to test, and the testing has to take place most probably twice a week, and it has to go on for a long period of time. If doing that just in the nursing homes would most probably use up the 1,000 tests that we're doing a day, because we've got a fair number of nursing homes through Missouri and the county, and quite honestly, the staff is usually three times the number of people in the nursing homes. So that is a large number of people who need testing. We also need to be able to test other people who have symptoms, not people who we think may have come in contact with someone. But if somebody comes in and says, I've got chest pain and a little bit of a cough or a dry cough, those people need testing, and they need testing straight away. That's the secret of doing good tracing. And all of this is not going to get done on 1,000 a day, I don't think.
No, there's a population of a million.
To do something.
There's a population of St. Louis County of a million.
Right.
People. Yeah. So we've got a ways to go. You know, I realize where there are a lot of us in the county. I live in the county. And, you know, I live in a nice isolated area. When I go out walking my dogs, I can keep it easy 10 to 20 feet away from anybody else in this area, which is very nice. But that's not the truth for the whole of the county. And we have to remember that there are parts of the county where people do live right on top of one another, and that's not going to be an easy solution.
Well, North County has been especially hard hit.
Of course.
And is that because of the population of African Americans, because you said they are at more risk?
And it's socioeconomic as well as having comorbidity. Populations who have more hypertension, more obesity, and more diabetes are at much greater risk. People who've smoked through their life, if they get the disease, are much likely to more likely to have death from the pneumonia that goes along with COVID, and people who are poor are less likely to go early to see a physician when they get sick.
And also living in closer proximity. Do you think there's kind of a cultural thing where you're more likely to have a couple of generations living together than perhaps in some parts of the county?
People who are poor live close together. Having lived through a life where I wasn't necessarily always rich, I'm doing fairly well now, thank you. But some of my life, I was very poor when I first came to the United States. And we had six of us living in one and a half bedrooms with my children, my mother, and my wife. You know, that sort of thing happens if you have very little money. You don't have a choice about how close together you live. So it's mainly a socioeconomic thing, I think, where people live on top of one another. And we have to recognize that that is a problem, that fixing some of those things in the long run will also fix a lot more of the diseases and pandemics we're going to see in the future. We need to have an American population who can all live the American dream.
Let me ask you about vitamin D. I've been reading some reports, some from credible sources and others I don't have much confidence in, but suggesting that vitamin D can have this traumatic or substantial effect on someone's ability to ward off the worst effects of this disease. Do you know anything about studies relating to vitamin D?
I know quite a lot about it, and we have published stuff on it pointing out why vitamin D is the emperor with no clothes. So many years ago, people decided that people who were sick had low levels of vitamin D, and only if they gave them vitamin D, they would all get better. The problem with this is what happens with sick people. If I'm sick, I don't go outside in the sun. If I don't go outside in the sun, I don't get vitamin D. And if I happen to be a dark-skinned person, my vitamin D is going to be lower, because basically when God created the earth, she realized that the people in Africa had very dark skin and they couldn't make vitamin D. So finishing up saying, well, let's have a much lower level of binding for vitamin D. So the way we measure vitamin D is a total vitamin D. It bears no relationship to the amount of vitamin D available in your tissue. And endocrinologists have known this for years, not only for vitamin D, but for all hormones. When we measure just a single value of a hormone without looking at how much is free, it has no real meaning. And basically, this is what's happened with vitamin D. The studies that came out, the most recent one, the Tilda study from Ireland, said people who get COVID have low vitamin D. These are basically the people who don't go outside, have many diseases, and those are the people who get COVID. So do we know that vitamin D will help COVID? We know that for some people, when the values are very low, you're going to get bone disease. But in our African-American population here, we showed that this level has to be most probably below 10 nanograms per mole. And quite honestly, the normal values are 20 to 25 if you go and look at the literature. So they have to be very low. So vitamin D turns out to be one of these things where it's very hard to find good data saying unless you give it to people whose values are extremely low, it actually helps anybody. But it's easily spread. There have been some great salespeople for vitamin D. It's a little bit like the old snake oil story, you know, where people went out and said, well, snake oil is going to be good for you because we know it was good for the people in China and we brought it to the United States. But we don't have the Chinese water snake, so we went to the rattlesnake. And the rattlesnake had much less what we would call today fish oil in it than the one in China. So fish oil may or may not be good for us, but certainly in the amounts that's in the rattlesnake, it was of no use whatsoever. But we had all these snake oil salesmen selling everywhere. And vitamin D has really been like that. It is the emperor with no clothes.
Doctor, vitamin D is, if someone has low vitamin D levels, could that be a genetic factor?
It could be. I mean, as I say, the first thing to realize is it's bound to a binding protein, and people who have a dark skin don't make as much vitamin D, but that's compensated for by the binding protein being much lower. So anybody from Africa, for instance, has a lower binding protein, lower vitamin D, and that's most probably when you're measuring total vitamin D, it's a genetic factor at that point of view. There are people who get vitamin D deficiency, which is true when they're young, and they do have some genetic factors, but that's a very small percentage of the population, and it's not the majority of the population that we're going to be seeing, particularly in the older adults.
And, Doctor, we know that casinos are very popular among seniors, and with Lumiere and Ameristar reopening, what is your advice to those seniors?
Well, my advice is don't go. For two reasons. One is you're most probably going to lose. But if you can overcome the fact that you're most probably going to lose, it's going to be very difficult to distance. If you go there and see people not wearing masks, you get out straight away. You still have to have the people around you wearing masks, and then maybe it is okay. And, you know, for older people, this has been a really bad time because by shutting everything down, you've created a loneliness epidemic. So giving people an opportunity to get out, to meet with other people at a distance, is something that's very important. Loneliness can cause depression. It can cause people to get weak, and it can cause heart disease as major things that we see in loneliness. And we have to recognize that treating loneliness is important. Treating malnutrition that may be related to the fact that people have lost their job and can't afford food, all of this is important, but we have to balance it. And balancing in the end is going to require everybody to wear a mask. Sorry if I sound like a old hacked record that doesn't play properly when I say this all the time, but the reality is the message I want people to get, and that includes the physicians who say don't wear a mask, is wearing masks is the only way we have with social distancing to make sure that we're not going to continue to have an endemic in the population.
What about wearing gloves?
Gloves are fine. I think it's useful to wear. Remember, if you wear gloves, you still can't touch your face. So that's the biggest problem, or your eyes or your nose, you know. And many of us tend to itch a lot. I'm as bad as anybody doing that. I just itched my eye. You know, this is the sort of thing that happens. And so you can't. The gloves are still going to carry the virus if it picks up from somewhere. So what we have to do is we have to wash our hands regularly. If we wear gloves, we've got to take them off without touching the outside parts and put them straight into a washer and wash them before we wear them again. So none of this is going to be easy. We understand it's not easy, but we need to do as much as we can to try and stop other people getting the disease and therefore stopping ourselves getting the disease.
Yes, we're talking with Dr. Morley, professor of St. Louis University's Division of Geriatric Medicine. Now, the last time you were on, I want to shift to kind of something a little more positive. We want to avoid people getting this disease, but the most exciting discussion is the possibility of the vaccine, which, as you suggested a while ago, even once we get it, there may be a few people that won't take it, but many will run to take it. And when you were on, when were you last on? It's about a little over a month ago. You believe that it was possible that there could be a vaccine maybe available by as early as November of this year. Are you still as optimistic about that possibility?
I think there are two or three vaccines out there that are almost on pace to do this. Some of it will depend on the FDA. If the FDA behaves the same way as they have done with the antibody, we may well have one by October at the rate they're going, you know. So there will be clearly data saying these vaccines produce antibodies, and they do it. Unfortunately, much of the testing has been done in young people. This is very ageist. You've got a disease that occurs mostly in older people. So how do the scientists set up to test it? They test it in young people because they say old people are more likely to have complications. Well, that's what we want to know. Are you going to have complications? It's better to do that in a randomized trial than wait and suddenly find out that the old people are getting sick and dying from the vaccine. But I think there is a fair hope that by November, December, January at the latest, we will have one or two versions of the vaccine around. There's lots of testing going on. And then it comes down to how convinced are we that it's going to work? And I think much of what we're going to be doing is basing it on, well, we get an antibody. We know that antibodies don't always solve the problem. And we know in the case of the coronavirus, its effects on the T cells are sometimes far more important than the antibody effects itself. So that may be T cells are the immune cells that float around in the body. And they are the things that keep us from getting sick. And if they go crazy, they give us cancer, autoimmune disease, and other things. And when they start to die off, that's how we get old. So they're very important. And we don't know for sure whether or not it's the antibody that's important for the coronavirus or whether it is the T cells. And there are people developing antibodies that will work directly on the T cells. And they can also have antibodies that work on the angiotensin converting enzyme receptor, which is the receptor 2. That receptor is the one that's in the lung and throughout the body that the virus finds to get itself into cells. It clumps onto that, and when it does that, it can dig a hole into the cell and get into the cell.
We're going to take a break right now and come back and talk to Dr. John Morley at St. Louis University. You're listening to Elder Talk with Tucker Allen, providing intelligent answers for those thinking about their future. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, your estate and elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Morley, Dr. John Morley, who's a professor at St. Louis University's Division of Geriatric Medicine. You know, we were talking about, before we went into the break, we had talked about the fact that there is some vulnerability, more vulnerability on the part of older people and some of the consequences of that and the testing. Should it start with the young? Should it start with the old? One thing that I think many of our listeners may be curious about, particularly those who've had this virus or who perhaps are experiencing symptoms, what is the course that this disease takes for most older people? And is there any residual problems that you see recurrent more among the old than the young? Though we know there's a higher death rate, but what about the healing process?
So we know that when any old person goes into hospital, they often lose a lot of muscle. If you go onto a ventilator, it can take you up to 5 years to get all your muscle back that you lost by spending 3 to 6 days on a ventilator. Many, many people with COVID are going to go on a ventilator to start with. So when we're looking at the COVID population, we're finding that these older people and also the younger people are taking longer to be able to walk again, longer to be able to do their function. Often they find it much harder to swallow and talk afterwards, and this is in the short term. But also COVID affects the muscles. The angiotensin converting enzyme 2 that we talked about is actually on the muscles. And so COVID gets into the muscles, it causes muscle pain, but it also causes muscle wasting.
I would think that they would be more prone to falling then.
Well, they're more prone to falling. They're also more prone to not being able to get about and run around. So all of this. So in the acute phase, we say they have cachexia, which is the wasting disease that you see commonly with cancer, for instance. But in the chronic phase, they have long-term sarcopenia, which is just the loss of muscle and the inability for that muscle to function. And this can take at least up to 6 months to actually bring back to a functional level for older people. So it's very important that you get yourself into a rehabilitation program, you find a way to do it. The problem with most rehabilitation programs is they pay for about 6 weeks, that's the medical insurance, and then afterwards they give you exercises and say, go and do them. And if you're anything like me, if somebody does that, I say, well, that's nice, I'll remember to do them sometime in the dim distant future. And particularly if you're weak, you're not going to do them. So we need to look at rearranging how we do exercise and rehabilitation for older people with COVID to make sure that they maintain that exercise at least up to 6 months.
So I was reading an article, I think this may have been the Wall Street Journal, where, and this has been several weeks ago, where they were finding that knee-jerk application of a ventilator to someone whose blood, you know, indicated low, I guess, blood oxygen, was turning out, for reasons that they didn't fully understand, to often not be the right thing, that they were getting better results by keeping these people off the ventilator and having them turn face down, as I recall.
If you put people prone, they do much better. And that's true on the ventilator as well, by the way, that if you turn the person over, and that's because of the way the lungs are shaped and how you manage to get air into the lungs. And quite honestly, with 50-odd years of medicine, I did not know this until COVID came along. So, you know, but somebody worked this out, and it makes a big difference to the COVID patients. A lot of the ventilator is not working because fundamentally you can't force oxygen in without forcing coronavirus into the lungs as well. So early on, if you go in too soon and the person is recovering, you may actually give them an extra dose of coronavirus. The oxygen's being blown in and it's blowing all the coronavirus that's sitting around in your mouth and around your nose directly into the lungs. And that's one of the problems that happens. So yes, ventilation is not right for most people or many people, and if possible you want to try and avoid it. This has been very difficult to work out who should and shouldn't get ventilation, and you know, on the whole, I think in many cases the physician is sitting there saying, let me try and prone the person first and see how it goes. It's particularly good to prone people who get what we call happy hypoxia. These are people whose oxygen levels in the blood go very low, but they are not short of breath at all. And so mm-hmm. that's another set of the population you've got to look at, and you've got to treat them, and you can't follow whether they're just short of breath, but you've got to follow what's going on with their oxygen at the same time. The other thing we have to realize is COVID gets in the brain. And when it gets in the brain, it makes you sometimes a little crazy, what we call medically delirium. And some of the delirium can be agitated. Some of it can be just that you don't respond to people. And early recognition of this and careful treatment, you don't tie people down when they've got delirium, though I still see this happening in hospitals all over the United States. If you do that in England, you get fired as a nurse or a doctor and you go to jail. And that's most probably the only way that people who do it should be treated. In my opinion, I know that many people don't agree with this. They say, oh, tie the person down, they won't be any trouble. Well, when you do that, they get sicker and it doesn't help. But we've got to recognize that we've got to pay attention to delirium. And there are ways to treat delirium, but it takes a lot of time and effort. And when you don't have a lot of people around, that becomes very hard.
So, doctor, if it hits the brain, COVID-19, are we talking possible permanent brain damage?
Well, not necessarily with the disease itself, though they're finding a lot of people post-COVID have more cognitive problems, i.e. not thinking as well as they did before. But in addition to this, as I think most people know now, COVID causes blood clots all over the body, and it can cause blood clots in the brain. Those are strokes, and that's permanent damage to the brain.
I'm thinking also about the symptom, perhaps more common among young people, of a loss of sense of taste or smell. That may, for younger people, be one of the first and most obvious signs for them that they have a problem. And I read recently that for some, this seems to not be going away. Do you know anything about what the course of that?
First of all, this occurs in old people as well, and it leads to severe anorexia. If you don't like the taste of food, you're not going to eat it. And so it's not limited to young people. The important part is a lot of it is due to the loss of smell. We always tend to think that when we're eating, basically we're eating because our taste makes us enjoy food. But most of taste is related to the aromatic amino acids that we give off the food in our mouth that we then waft up through the post parts of our nose and sniff, and it goes to the olfactory organ. There's fairly good evidence now that COVID does do damage to, within the brain, the olfactory organ. That's the organ that controls smell. So this is why I think it's not coming back in a lot of people.
And do you think it may not come back at all, or do you think most of these things, even the memory issues and whatnot, do you think many of those tend to come back? It'll just take perhaps months?
You know, we haven't had COVID around long enough to ask me what I think, because what I think is a pure guess. What I hope is these things will come back. We do a lot of work with people who have brain problems, and we've shown that if we work hard with them doing cognitive stimulation therapy, looking to make sure that they don't have treatable causes, we can improve memory quite a bit in many people who other people would say, well, they've just got Alzheimer's disease and do nothing. So we can do things, and I'm assuming and hoping we will be able to do things to help the people with COVID. But that's something that if you ask me in about 5 years' time, I will be able to give you an honest answer. At the moment, it is a hopeful answer.
We'll have to book you for a show 5 years from now. But we have about 2 more minutes left. I want to get in your thoughts on this. We talked, I think, briefly last time about the fact that Sweden was charting a little different course from its neighbors and from the rest of Europe, I guess. And to kind of get your thoughts on, we're further down the road now. Sweden has gone up and down, but in its gross domestic product is doing better than other neighboring countries. What are your comments on that general approach to dealing with this virus versus more of a lockdown?
So to be fair, I was hoping you wouldn't remember that I'd said that last time. So it's recognized. Sweden has done what we would call herd immunity. It's what Britain decided to try and do and then said no. So if you look around the rest of the countries around Sweden, they've had much less deaths. Sweden has had huge numbers of deaths in the nursing homes, particularly. They still don't have a huge death rate compared to, say, Italy or France and places like that for the total population. But they really haven't done as well as I thought they would do. They do have a very large now, low socioeconomic population. They mainly came from Eastern Asia, and you know, they had huge immigration when people were trying to get out of different parts of the Eastern Asia because of problems there. That population lives very much on top of one another. There's no way they can socially distance. So to justify what I said last time about the Swedes, I still have a fair amount of faith in the Swedes as a whole, but the low socioeconomic population, I don't think was in a position to do any of those things. I think the question is going to be down the line, was most of the problems in that population? And that would make sense because of, again, the problem in low socioeconomic groups of not being able to social distance. On the other hand, I was most probably being nicer about the Swedes than they deserve. That means that I've got too many Swedish friends.
Well, actually, you know, I was rooting and am rooting for the Swedes because I'm thinking the next time that a pandemic comes around, you know, whether it's 10, 20, or 30 years, whatever, that we will have a better strategy that doesn't require that we shut the economy down. So,
I think that was true this time. If we had thought it through, if we could have convinced everybody to wear masks, to socially distance, we most probably did not have to shut the economy down. We most probably had to take the older population and get them to shut down, but not the rest of the population, if we did all the right things. But you're a lawyer. You tell me how you get Americans to behave reasonably, even on a good day. It's not that easy.
No, no. And if they started behaving reasonably, I'd be out of business.
But, well, that would be fine for my position as a physician, but you most probably wouldn't be happy with it.
Yeah, I think your profession would be in the cheering section for that outcome. But any case, I am glad to hear you say that, though, because I don't hear enough doctors acknowledge the economic costs of this. And so it is encouraging to hear you be so considerate of the cost of that aspect.
And I will point out, I was asked by somebody close to the Pence committee early on what they should do. And you just heard what I told them to do. And guess what? They didn't listen.
Well,
you and I are clearly totally wrong because nobody else believes we were right.
Well, no, I think the chances we're right are better when we're in the minority. But in any case, I do, you know, you have a lot of wisdom and a lot of knowledge. I'm amazed how familiar you are with each of these topics we talked about. So it reminds me why you were a popular guest from our last show. So if it's okay, we'd like to circle back with you in a month or so, if your schedule permits, and visit
again.
And as
I said last time, I'd love to come back and talk about real geriatric problems and the things that people can do. And we know how to fix, okay?
It's marvelous having you as a guest, Dr. Morley, and I hope that we'll talk again soon.
Great speaking to both of you, and thank you very much for having me back on.
Thank you, Dr.
Take
Morley.
Care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Tucker Ellen, providing intelligent answers for those thinking about their future, with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, your estate and elder law advisors. For more information, visit tuckerallen.com. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Tucker Allen. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.